tame-made excuse to really put women in their place in society, a shocking way of doing so. And women were already subservient to men, but this really just took it to a different level altogether.
That was Tracy Borman discussing her new book about the history of witches.
They appeal to us because they show similarities between medieval people and modern people, but they also show great differences.
And that was Deborah Thorpe on medieval letter writing. Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar, and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. See historyextra.com/subscribe-today for subscription deals. And we have digital editions available for the iPad, for the Kindle Fire, for Google Play and for Zinio. For details of all of those, head to historyextra.com/digital. The witch hunting mania of the 16th and 17th centuries was an infamous period of British history. Little is known, however, about the lives of many of the women caught up in this craze. In her new book, historian Tracy Borman explores a story of Margaret, Philippa and Joan Flower, who were accused of bringing about the deaths of two young boys in Leicestershire. Tracy spoke to our reviews editor, Matt Elton, about what the case can tell us about society in this period, and also explores the links to King James VI and I.
What do we talk about when we talk about witches in this particular context?
Well, when you imagine a witch today, it's very much, you know, pointy hat, broomstick, that kind of wicked witch of the West sort of image that we have. Well, actually, that's extraordinarily old. You think that that's perhaps a Hollywood invention, but witches have been depicted like that for centuries. I came across, when studying for this book, for doing the research, I came across an image from the 15th century of just that kind of witch. And so that's what she looked like. What she did, there were basically black witches who tried to cause evil and harm to their neighbours and friends or other members of the community through spells and other sort of dark arts. And then there were white witches who were the opposite. They tried to do only good. They were healers. They would find lost property. They would even detect crimes. And so it was very much a contrast between the evil in society, and then they were, could also be a force for good.
Do we get a sense of how far this idea had entered the public consciousness?
It absolutely was intrinsic to the public consciousness. It had been for you know, hundreds, if not thousands of years. Witches are very prominent in the Bible, but they'd been around in Roman and Greek mythology as well. So it was absolutely an intrinsic belief within society.
Do we know why people in this particular period had become so superstitious?
Well, in the 16th and 17th century, it was a time of economic hardship. There were many plagues. It was great population growth. So there was chronic underemployment. Generally, it was quite a miserable time. So people were looking for a scapegoat. And therefore, witches provided the perfect outlet for their anger, their bitterness at their sort of hard lot in society. So they would look to their local wise woman or white witch, if you like. And suddenly, there was a crueler twist on the image of a witch, and many would be accused of doing all sorts of things, from causing crops to fail to murdering children and all untold evils. But the other big factor in this period was, certainly in England, was James I, who had brought his obsession with witchcraft down with him from Scotland when he inherited the throne from Elizabeth. And so suddenly you get an absolute explosion of witch hunting during his reign.
It's a fascinating period, and your book touches on a particular case study amongst all this. How did you first learn about Joan, Margaret and Philippa Flower?
That's right. Well, what I wanted to do was look at one case in great detail. And I knew of the Flower women's case because they were hanged in Lincoln, and that's my hometown. So it's sort of something of a local legend, although not that well known elsewhere. So I wanted to find out more about that. And the more I found out, the just more fascinating it became, because it was in many respects an absolutely stereotypical example of a witchcraft trial. You know, these poor women had done very little. to deserve suspicion. They were just a bit unpopular in their local community. Misfortune befalls the inhabitants of Beaver Castle in Leicestershire, where they worked, and the two young sons of the Earl of Rutland die, and suddenly the finger of suspicion is pointed at these women, and they just find themselves on the wrong end of a witch hunt, literally.
So these women worked at the place where this manor's family lived, is that right?
That's right, they worked at Beaver Castle. They'd been brought in, I think, as a form of temporary employment, because King James was very fond of Beaver Castle. He was great friends with the Earl of Rutland, and whenever he visited, it was all hands on deck and they had to employ more people, and I think that's when the flower women were brought in. But they were not popular with the other servants. I think they tried to lord it over them a bit, because they used to be much richer than they were. They'd fallen on hard times, and so they weren't popular. The other servants wanted an excuse to get rid of them. And so when, very conveniently, the Earl's two boys fell dangerously ill, of course, everybody started whispering that it was really the curse of those flower women.
How did James first get involved in the family, first of all?
Well, the Rutlands, the Earls of Rutland, had been associated closely with the crown for quite some time, and had always been, you know, very prominent at court and in service to the king or queen. And so there was a good precedent. When James came to the throne, he would have known the manor's family. Beaver Castle was one of the first places he chose to visit upon coming down to England from Scotland in 1603. And they seemed to have a meeting of minds, even though the Earl of Rutland was actually a closet Catholic, and James was, of course, quite a puritanical monarch. They had a great deal else in common, and James loved to hunt in the grounds of Beaver, and they would discuss politics. The other thing that united them was a passion for witch hunting, and that's really where they found a common interest.
Do we know how much James's love of witch hunting was kind of developed through this relationship, or was it something that he had anyway?
I think it's something he very much had anyway. I think this obsession with witchcraft began when he was King of Scotland, and he had been betrothed to Anne of Denmark. And in a uncharacteristically brave and romantic gesture, he decided to go and fetch Anne himself, because she tried to sail over to Scotland and been battered back by violent storms. But when James tried to sail across, he almost lost his life, because it was such a violent tempest. And when he eventually reached Denmark, Denmark was gripped by witch hunting fervor too, as was Scotland. And it was whispered to James that perhaps witches had been to blame, and that they'd conjured up spells to bring about this storm and cause the death of the king. And from that moment on, James became absolutely convinced that witches were a force of evil in his kingdom, and he needed to get rid of them. And he rounded up about 70, mostly women, whom he believed had been part of this plot to bewitch his fleet and make it sink and cause the death of their king.
The book touches on the fact that he begins to see himself as God's tool, kind of his instrument to do this work.
That's right. And he makes lots of reference to that. So, you know, he's basically, his theme is that he's God's representative, God's advocate here on earth to do his bidding. And so everything is sanctioned by God. And he makes that very clear in the book that he writes about witchcraft, demonology. He's the only monarch to do so. He makes it clear that, you know, God has appointed him for this task. He seems absolutely convinced about that and about the justice of his cause.
Going back to the, you know, the children in this case, do we know why they became ill? Is that any way clear?
Well, there are symptoms that they displayed which are very, very similar to epilepsy. And it was said at the time by some medical authorities that they had the falling sickness, as it was known. And of course, it was quite a terrifying illness, because there would be convulsions and foaming at the mouth and sudden fevers. And so people, it looked like people were suddenly bewitched. It came on very, very quickly, as we know today. So I think it may well have been, and modern day doctors and physicians have analysed the symptoms of those boys, and they said that they are, you know, very much in line with what we'd expect from epileptics today.
So given that we've touched on the fact that they weren't that popular in the community anyway, what role did other people, kind of local to them, play in their being blamed for this?
They were absolutely instrumental. It seems, ironically, even though the Earl was interested in witch hunting, that it was the servants at the castle, it was the people of the local community who were really responsible for the witch hunt. The Earl and his wife didn't want to listen to the rumours at first about the flower men. I think they thought quite highly of them. So it was very much a witch hunt by the local community. The flower women were deeply unpopular. It was said that they were immoral. They would welcome men into their house at all hours of the night. They were always uttering curses against their neighbours. Basically, nobody liked this family and they wanted to get rid of them. And so it was started from the bottom up. It wasn't a case of the Earl and his wife just sacking these women because they immediately thought they were to blame. It was only after an intense pressure from the other servants in the castle that they decided to act.
So what happened next?
So I think it was probably the Countess who ordered their arrest, because the Earl was then at court in London celebrating Christmas with the King. And the flower women were arrested. There is no evidence that they were tortured at that stage. But I think circumstantially, it's very, very possible, because what you tend to get in this period, even though torture is illegal, except for traitors, it's sort of a case of vigilante justice, really, by the local community. And I think lots of witches were swum, you know, when they were tied up and dunked in their local lake, and if they sank they were innocent, and if they rose to the top they were guilty. So a lot of this went on, and I think it's quite possible that the local community subjected Joan and her daughters to this, because when they'd only gone about 10 miles north of Beaver Castle on their journey to Lincoln, Joan suddenly fell down dead. Now it's said that she had called for a trial by bread, whereby she said, if I can eat this piece of bread and don't choke on it, then I am innocent. And the reason it was thought that was a proper trial is that, of course, bread was representative of Christ's body, and so anyone evil would not be able to take it into their own body. And it said that Joan took this piece of bread, and as she tried to swallow it, she choked and died.
And so when they did reach trial, what happened then?
Well, so her daughters, Margaret and Philippa, made it to Lincoln. They were interrogated for several weeks and placed in what's still known as the Witch's Hole, a particularly awful, dank, dark, disease-ridden dungeon in Lincoln Castle. Eventually, they reached their trial in March 1619. Now, suspected witches were not allowed any form of defence. They had to defend themselves. They weren't given any counsel. And it seems that Margaret and Philippa, according to the contemporary account, were completely unrepentant. They said, absolutely, we're witches. We've been consorting with devils while we're in prison. You know, can we believe this? I think it's rather suspect myself, unless they were just, you know, so terrified by what stood before them that they'd become kind of hysterical, which is a possibility. It didn't take very long at all, probably as little as 20 minutes, the average witchcraft trial was, to reach a verdict. And of course, that verdict was guilty. And just a few days later, the girls were taken to the outskirts of the castle, where they were hanged in front of a large crowd.
I mean, so there seems there's no winners in this at all. But there is some evidence in the book that you suggest there's been a miscarriage of justice, so that someone gains from this.
Is that right? That's right. And while I don't wish to sort of do a witch hunt of my own, I think there is more than circumstantial evidence to point the finger of blame actually at the Duke of Buckingham. Now, he was the King's great favourite. And how was he involved? Well, he wanted to marry the Earl of Rutland's daughter. She was the daughter from his first marriage, so the half-sister of those two boys who died. And it was only when the second boy died, and he survived about 6 or 7 years longer than his brother, it's only when he died that Buckingham finally agreed to marry Catherine, the half-sister, because she now stood to inherit the entire Rutland fortune. It was one of the richest and most distinguished families in the country. So he had a lot to gain. He was known to retain a poisoner on his books. His mother, who also dabbled in poisons, lived lived very close to Beaver. Now, all of this, admittedly, is fragmentary evidence. So I'm not saying that he absolutely had a hand in those two boys' deaths, but he certainly had a stronger motive than the flower women. And he also commissioned, after their deaths, basically a whitewash account of their trial, which just completely left no room for doubt of their guilt. Now, why would he have paid for that publication? He also paid for the youngest son's funeral very, very quickly after his death. So he was buried almost immediately. And, you know, there were whispers that, you know, he didn't want the boy's body examined too closely. So who knows? But it's just interesting to speculate that, in fact, this couldn't have been just an ordinary witchcraft trial. It may have been a conspiracy.
And talking about people gaining from all this, what did James stand to gain from spreading the idea of witchcraft?
I think for him it was very much a personal crusade, an ideological one. He wasn't necessarily going to get more power by it. I don't think that's what it was about. He genuinely had very, very strong convictions that witches were evil and that they needed to be rooted out. And I think he came to believe his own image as being the you know, God's representative on earth and to do away with witches. But the thing is with James is that he was quite fickle, really. He tended to get these obsessions and they wouldn't necessarily last all that long. Now, the witchcraft one lasted, admittedly, probably longer than any of other James's obsessions. But by the time of his death in 1625, it was said that he was more interested in hunting deer than he was in hunting witches. He'd completely cooled off on the whole thing, and the witch hunts really died down as a result.
It's strange that one person's kind of psychology can affect a whole nation to such an extent, isn't it?
Oh, completely. And James really was a figurehead. And that's why you get the likes of, you know, Shakespeare writing Macbeth. And then there's Dr. Faustus by Marlowe. You know, to flatter the king, society wanted to believe in the same thing as the king, or at least to be seen to believe. And so it was enormously influential. Here was this king. He was publishing books on witchcraft. He was watching plays about it. He was giving speeches about it. So, of course, if you want to get in with the king, you've got to pretend to be as passionate about rooting out witches from society.
What can all this teach us about women in the period and their social position?
I think one historian very rightly wrote that it wasn't just witch hunting, it was woman hunting. As many as 85% of those convicted were women. And actually the percentage was really high in this country. And for example, in France, it was about 50-50 between men and women. But on the whole, if you average it out, women were definitely the more numerous among those convicted for witchcraft. And so it was very much a misogynistic craze. It was about putting women back in their place. They'd started to get more independence, perhaps during the later medieval period. And the Pope in the 15th century was instrumental. He published a bull against witches, and it was very much in the feminine gender, the wording of the bull. And this was followed by a whole rash of publications, and suddenly people were interpreting the Bible's references to witches in the feminine gender, even though actually they're not. That there are male witches, there are female witches in the Bible, but it became an excuse to really put women in their place in society, a shocking way of doing so. And women were already subservient to men, but this really just took it to a different level altogether.
You touched on there that James was fickle and eventually kind of abandoned this idea to some extent. Do we get a sense of at what point the idea in society generally kind of died down?
Well, it was remarkably enduring. Of course, the real fire had gone out of witch hunting by the time of James's death, but it came back with dramatic effect during the Civil War, when you get the witch finder general, Matthew Hopkins, with that sudden brief craze in the middle of the 17th century. But after that, it really is on the wane, and you get the rise of more rational scientific thinking. Although, that's too simplistic to say suddenly people understood more about the world, therefore they didn't believe in witches. It was still quite a deep-seated belief. And even today, you know, that people are still, they have little suspicions, they might have little rituals, they might not necessarily believe in them in the same way. But we still do lots of things, you know, just our phraseology, oh, fingers crossed and that kind of thing. You know, it's still alive today. And then, you know, more seriously, movements such as Wicca, I've been contacted by lots of people from that movement since publishing my book, and I'm now, I think I was sort of, you know, top of the Wicca books bestsellers list or something like that.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
Which is not something I've ever been before. So it's obviously still an incredibly popular movement, but it's gone back to being positive. So it's much more about white witches and about, you know, using magic and witchcraft for good in society, I think.
Mm. Talking about your research, what sources did you use most when you were kind of writing the book?
Well, I did a lot of research into the archives of Beaver Castle. So even sort of what looks like on the surface very dry documents such as account books and the like, they're very revealing about the flower women's time at the castle and what they were up to and their loss of status, as I mentioned earlier. But most of my research took place in the British Library, and it involved many, many contemporary pamphlets which were written to record the individual witchcraft trials, and particularly the one, of course, of the flower women. But these were an amazing resource for the historian, because, you know, they might not necessarily be incredibly accurate, but they reflect what people thought of witches at the time. So they were written in kind of shocked language and to aim to whip up popular fear and suspicion of witches in their local community. So they're an absolutely fantastic source.
What would you say was the thing that most surprised you in the course of your research?
I think what most surprised me, I mean, apart from the, you know, potential scandal of the Duke of Buckingham's involvement, was just the scale of the witch hunts and, you know, just how little chance these women stood, and that they could, you know, an accusation was enough. An accusation stood up in court. They didn't need a confession. They didn't need any corroborating evidence. So really, if you're accused, then pretty much you could be sure that either you were going to lose your life or your life would be ruined. Because even if you were acquitted at trial, you would be the black sheep of your community. And there's many accounts, horrific accounts of the abuse that was heaped onto women who'd been acquitted for witchcraft. And basically, their lives weren't worth living. So it was just the sheer terror. And I really got a sense of that sheer terror that women must have felt at the time, and just how easy it was to be convicted as a witch.
It's scary, isn't it? And what message about the period do you hope that people take away from the book?
Well, I think, you know, we might not still believe in witches in the same way, but I think we probably, or society and the world generally, still has, you know, witch hunts of a type. There's still, you know, there's we've seen in you know, living memory, the Holocaust, and just how terrifying movements like that can be, where, you know, it just takes one charismatic figure to convince people that there's an evil in society, it needs to be rooted out. And the Holocaust was really like the witch hunts of its time. And so, you know, it is quite disturbing to think that actually this is a recurring theme in society. One likes to think that we're becoming more rational all the time and, you know, a more enlightened society, but it's still possible to have witch hunts of different kinds, I think.
That was Tracy Borman. Tracy's new book, Witches, A Tale of Sorcery, Scandal and Seduction, is out now, published by Jonathan Cape. And Tracy has also written a piece for our October issue about King James VI and I's involvement in the witch craze. Also in this month's magazine, we're investigating the mystery of the princes in the Tower, we're examining the Victorians' obsession with murder, we're highlighting Britain's fashion icons, and we're challenging some myths of the Blitz. If any of that takes your fancy, then why not pick up a copy at all good newsagents or try one of our digital formats. And speaking of our digital formats, if you own an iPad, you can now access our Battle of Flodden interactive article free of charge. Simply download the BBC History Magazine app and you can get it from there. With no postal service in England in the 15th century, sending letters could often prove quite a challenge. Deborah Thorpe, who has been studying messages from the period, spoke to our features editor, Charlotte Hodgman, about the letter writing and sending process, and about what such documents can tell us about the sender and the recipient.
So, Deborah, your feature examines how letters and parcels were sent from A to B in medieval England, and it does sound like a rather complicated process, which we'll go into in a little bit. But firstly, what sort of people were writing letters at this time, and for what sort of reasons?
There was really a vast array of people, different kinds of people that would send letters, since the subject matter of letters is so diverse. It sort of ranges from royalty down to the aristocracy, to gentry and merchants who, and really the subject matter ranges from anything from property administration, the management of servants, the conducting business via letters, or of course something that concerned a lot of letter writers at the time, which was the management of legal issues and addressing legal matters at court.
And what would a medieval letter have actually looked like, and you know, how was it written and presented, and you know, what did the actual physical letter look like at the end of the process?
So a medieval letter would also always begin with an opening formula of address, mm-hmm. and that would be the equivalent of our dear sir, dear madam, but it can often be very surprising in how elaborate it is, because the opening formula of address really established the relationship between the sender and the recipient. So you could establish the level of formality. If you were writing to a superior, you might address the person you're writing to as the right honourable and well-beloved friend. Or if you were writing to someone who's below you in status, you would use a completely different formula. It's very codified and very important that they would get the right form of address. And then you would move on to the main body of the letter, which would deal with a sequence of different matters that the sender wanted to address. And then followed by the closing formula, which was as important as the opening formula and often wished the addressee good wishes for their health and offered a return address for how they could send their reply.
Okay. And how, you know, what was it actually written on and what with?
The most common material for letters was paper. In the 15th century or the later Middle Ages that I deal with in my research, and written with ink. And I found an example in the Paston letters of a letter being needed to be sent very quickly. And so the letter's ink is dried with the ashes from the chimney by the sender of the letter at the time.
And were they, you know, did they put them in envelopes or, you know, a medieval version of an envelope, or were they just folded and sent?
Well, the security of the letter was very important. Who got access to that letter was very important. So the letter would usually be folded and then tied up with a strip of paper, perhaps recycled from a piece of scrap. And then a wax seal would be applied, with which the recipient of the letter could tell whether someone had already opened it and read it.
And presumably the sort of letters that you've been studying have been written by sort of mainly middle class and upper class people who could actually write. Was that the case, or have you found anything sort of surprising?
The highest of the high status people would generally use scribes, and those scribes would be usually literate members of the household, so literate servants, who could be of surprisingly high status themselves. They were often the second son of a local family who had quite a bit of independent wealth, but often servants of the household would correspond with each other. And that's often quite interesting because the letters might display different dialect features than ones that were written for the gentleman, the lord of the house. So that's quite an interesting feature.
Okay. So your letter's been written and it's all ready to go. What happened next? How did you ensure that it got where you wanted it to go?
Well, the next stage in the letter sending process would be to find a messenger. And that could often be quite a troublesome task in itself. The preferred option would be to use one of your own servants because you knew them very well, and often the recipient of the letter might know them also. So you could establish a relationship between yourself and the recipient by using a well-trusted servant. But often servants just simply weren't available because they were needed for other duties. So in which case you might hire a messenger. And there's several pieces of evidence for people paying messengers who might be not so well known to the sender of the letter. And then finally, you could send it along with some goods that you might be sending around the country, which was a useful way of sending a letter if it was going along a well-established trade route, such as between Norwich and London.
So there were professional messengers, you know, that was their job, that they took letters for various people as and when needed.
Absolutely. That's part of my current research, which is looking into the work of professional messengers, because it's something that hasn't really been researched a great deal up until this point. But there is evidence within books of accounts for professional messengers having been paid for their services.
And could you have earned quite a comfortable living doing that?
That's another thing that more research needs to be done on at the moment, about the payment of messengers and how they might earn a living or whether they have another source of income. From what the research that I've done so far, it's clear to see that it really depended on what kind of messenger you were. The messengers that were used by royalty, for example, I found one piece of evidence to show that they were paid, one royal messenger was paid twice as much as a normal messenger who was just taking businessmen or merchants' letters.
Okay, it's quite interesting, isn't it? The different levels of people who could take those sorts of letters.
Absolutely.
And travelling in medieval England could be pretty dangerous. So, what sort of hazards could a messenger face en route, and how did they make sure that their letter cargo, you know, remained safe for the journey?
As I've mentioned before, the security of the letter was of paramount importance, especially if you were sending evidence for a legal case, or there's one example of a member of the Seeley family who were based in between Calais and London, sending gold with their letters. So it was very important that the letter wasn't intercepted by unfriendly hands. So there was the risk of the letter being lost or misdirected or intercepted by an unfriendly person. And there's one example that I found from the Paston family correspondence of some money that was being sent from Norwich to London for safekeeping. And the person who was taking the money accidentally put a letter in with the bag and sent it to London instead of it being sent on to its intended address in Norfolk. So it was very clear that there was a very real risk of letters being lost or misdirected.
And do we know whether messengers would not get paid if they didn't deliver their letters in, you know, a certain amount of time or by, you know, a deadline?
That's something as well that I'm looking into, because there seems to be some evidence that messengers would be paid on the delivery of their letter, which of course meant that they were especially eager to reach their point of delivery on time and with the correct item that they're supposed to be carrying. But there is evidence that still some messengers didn't go to the greatest efforts to take their letter on time. There is one example from the Paston correspondence of a letter writer handing a letter to the messenger, and then the messenger didn't leave Norwich for 5 days. So the letter obviously didn't reach its direction at the intended time.
But there's still less chance of them sort of chucking it over a hedge and pretending they delivered it.
Absolutely. And there is some evidence of messengers going to a great deal of effort to reach the recipient, such as staying over for a night or waiting around, waiting around until someone had returned from hunting with his hawk. So the messenger actually waited until he returned home and then handed the letter over, which indicates that perhaps he was waiting for his payment.
Okay. And I mean, today's postmen don't usually have to act as intermediaries, but in your feature you mentioned that medieval messengers often had to act as diplomats when they arrived at their destination. Why was that?
Well, there are several different reasons. perhaps because often correspondents might be nurturing very unstable relationships between each other. Such as in Norfolk in the 15th century, there was a very complex county politics, and often letters were used as a way of nurturing relationships between neighbours. And in my letter, I talk about Catherine, the servant of Margaret Paston, who took a letter on behalf of Margaret Paston to one of their enemies in the region, and she was actually required to act as a diplomat because no male servant was willing to take the message. And there is evidence that she was received very well, and she was treated very kindly by the recipient. So it seems that she did her job very well.
So presumably, when you employed a messenger, you'd want to know that they were, you know, able to do that sort of thing when they were delivering this letter, they weren't going to make matters worse.
Of course, and that's another good reason why you would use a servant, because you would know them well. You might choose a servant who would be appropriate to take that message according to their relationship with the recipient, whether they'd met them before and they were able to provide a spoken element to accompany the written words. And often, of course, not the entire message would be committed to the page, especially if it was sensitive information that you might not want to leave a written record of. So the servant might provide that message by mouth and speak the message so as not to create that written record.
It sounds like there's a lot of trust put into these servants and messengers. You know, they were sort of handling quite often quite sensitive information, you know, that could be used, you know, against their employer. So is that quite normal?
It seems so. There's a lot of evidence for a huge amount of trust that's being given to servants, certainly, who are taking letters. William Worcester, who was the secretary of Sir John Fastolf, was a very highly trusted servant. There is evidence of him being part of the administration of Fastolf's will. So he was obviously someone who would be trusted to give the message accurately and to convey his master's wishes accurately and appropriately.
And have you found any evidence to the contrary, you know, so people who have not delivered messages properly or have, you know, maybe opened letters and things like that, and they haven't reached their intended destination?
I haven't found any direct evidence, but I have found evidence of anxiety from letter writers who will write and check up that a letter has reached its destination, which indicates that they were half expecting it to have been lost. And there's also evidence of an antagonistic relationship between two letter writers who one of them writes to say, please don't blame the letter bearer for this. So obviously there's some evidence that the letter bearer might be, the messenger might indeed have been shot.
So that's where it comes from, that term, I suppose.
It seems so. I mean, they're being entrusted with a lot of responsibility. So it seems that, especially if they were a trusted servant, a well-respected servant, the master would try their utmost to protect their reputation.
And what happened to those letters after they were delivered? Were they usually kept and stored somewhere, or, you know, were they destroyed?
Well, we have the great storage methods of the Paston family to thank for the survival of many of these letters now. The Pastons were very preoccupied with storing their letters. And Sir John Fastolf, whose letters I have been studying, he had a specialised storage system in his manor house at Caister Castle in Norfolk. And although he did store his letters, there's some evidence that perhaps his storage system wasn't really up to the task of retrieval of those letters once they'd been put away. His stepson, Stephen Scroope, who spent a lot of time at Caister Castle, wrote to one of Fastolf's other servants to say that he'd had difficulty finding a letter that had been put away in the storage area. So although they were storing letters, perhaps they weren't so easy to find afterwards.
Sounds familiar. but presumably letters of a sensitive nature would have been destroyed then.
Well, the fact that the instructions to destroy these letters survive indicate that not all of them actually were destroyed. Obviously, it's impossible to know how many were. But unfortunately for the people that requested for letters to be destroyed, there was an equal desire to keep evidence. Written evidence was of great use in legal cases. We know that letters of correspondence were used as evidence in legal cases. So the desire to destroy written records was equaled by the desire to keep them. So...
Yeah, I mean, a lot of your research does seem to have been around correspondence relating to the Paterson family. And I mean, I remember studying them as a student, and they really are a remarkable set of documents. What have you learned from them? And are they, do you think they're typical of families of the period?
Well, the Paterson correspondence is remarkable for its volume. It's remarkable for the array of different subject matters that are dealt with in the letters. The corpus is very rich in social information, rich in political information. So it's of great interest to scholars and members of the public alike. But there are other corpora of letters that survive from the 15th century. Perhaps they're not quite so lively in their content, but they do survive. There's the Seeley family correspondence, which I mentioned earlier, which is very interesting because it involves letters passing to and forth between Calais and London. It deals with the lives of people who were involved in the wool trade in Calais. So that tells us a lot about medieval trade and medieval craft. And then if you're interested in other geographical areas, there's the Plumpton family of Yorkshire. And they had quite a substantial body of letters that have survived, but they have been comparatively understudied compared to the Paterson family. So there's still a great deal of work to be done on medieval letters.
And what do you think they can sort of tell us about what was going on around these families at the time?
Well, the great thing about medieval letters is they appeal to us because they show similarities between medieval people and modern people, but they also show great differences. So they're of great interest to historians and members of the public who want to know about the way that family relationships were conducted, the way that marriages were arranged, and the way that properties were managed. All those kind of things that are of great interest to historians, letters contain information about. So I think really the diversity of subject matter that letters deal with is of great appeal.
So you'd recommend people having a looking up the Paterson family, would you, to get a feel for medieval England?
Absolutely. And I think I spoke in my article about an altercation between servants that were associated with the Paterson family, and it's so lively, the subject matter is so lively that it just draws you in and it makes you want to read about their day-to-day lives. And the other thing that comes out of the Paterson family is the great strength of the women of the Paterson family. Margaret Paterson, who was left at their estate in Norfolk to manage the property whilst her husband was away for vast periods of time. And she was not only managing a substantial estate, but she was dealing with problems between the Pastons and their neighbours. And in my article, I talk about the defence of the property against attackers, and she was administrating that whole process. So it tells us a great deal about women in the 15th century.
Yeah, and was that a common occurrence then for women to have been left in charge of estates?
Well, that's the great appeal of the Paterson letters, really. It tells us about one woman and her role in estates, and I think that's why they're unique. But certainly that doesn't come out as much from other corpora of letters. So I think that's one of the reasons the Paterson letters is so appealing to us.
And when and why did this system of delivering post change?
Well, I discuss and I gave a reference to Duncan Campbell-Smith's book on the masters of the post, the sort of official postal system that was introduced in the 16th century. The first master of the post was appointed in 1512, and that really came out of a desire to regulate this quite rather difficult postal system to sort of bring some reliability into it. And that was implemented by royalty. There was a desire to establish a royal post, and that was done by appointing horse riding messengers who would be appointed at different points across the country, and one would ride to the next and one would ride to the next. So that was really the first official postal system, and that was established in 1512. But that book is very interesting in charting the development of what we might recognise today as a postal system.
Yeah, but I mean, do you think people still use their servants and other people to deliver personal messages?
Oh, I think so, most definitely. This royal official postal system took a long time to sort of hit the ground, and certainly people of the gentry or even the aristocracy would still be using this more informal system to deliver letters. As we know, any sort of official system takes a while to get established.
That was Deborah Thorpe. You can read more about medieval post in an article that appeared in our September issue, which is still available to order as a back issue and, of course, digitally. Find more details of all this at our website, historyextra.com. And that is almost all for this week. Do get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we might even read it out in a future episode. Plus, you can follow us on social media. On Twitter, we're at History Extra. Plus, there's Facebook, facebook.com/History Extra. And don't forget to visit our website, where, as well as subscription deals, you can find history news, blogs, features, image galleries, and lots more. Next week, we'll be talking about murders with Lucy Worsley, and we'll be heading to the Neolithic with Richard Bradley. Do join us for that. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced, as ever, by Jack Fletcher.